Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Game Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. On this channel, we talk about new and recent publications that deal with digital games as cultural artifacts, the act of playing with them, and the production and social paradigms of the industries behind them. My name is Rudolf Indest, the host of the channel. Before we jump right in, though, I want to let you know that if you like our show, please leave us a 5-stars review on Apple Podcasts or the audio platform of your very choice. You're more than welcome to leave feedback or questions on Spotify as well. Also, feel free to share this episode with your friends or wherever you see fit. And another, by the way, this is the channel episode number 100. And now back to the show. Today, we have a fascinating guest with us, Peter MacDonald, author of the book Run and Jump, The Meaning of the 2D Platformer. The publisher is MIT Press. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rudolf. I'm thrilled to be here.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Absolutely. I've been thinking and working and making games for over 20 years now. I started back in the early 2000s in the game industry as a tester and as an animator for Electronic Arts and then for an independent studio in Vancouver. And the game industry at that point was a bit of a different place. I didn't find it a place where I could think through the complex ways that I wanted to, how games were working. And so I went back into academia and have had a kind of multidisciplinary career. I got my PhD in English literature. I worked in a game design department, and now I'm at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Department of Curriculum Instruction, where I teach educational game design and theories of games to education students.
Now, of course, we have to check for your Ludo Street credibility. Please tell us, what's your favorite game and the one or even the ones you're playing right now?
So I'm playing right now a game called Balatro, which is a poker game. It's a poker roguelike game that really scratches an itch of just making the biggest number you possibly can by stacking your deck in all these ways. But my favorite game, and sort of in the vein of today's theme, my favorite 2D platforming game has to be Rain World. And for those who haven't played it, Rain World is an absolutely beautiful game that doesn't care that you're there. So you play this kind of cat-like creature that is not the lowest element of the food chain, but pretty low on the food chain. And the game simulates the life cycle of the entire world. So all these predators are hunting each other and hunting you. They give birth and die out. And that sense that you are just one piece of this rich tapestry of the world as you kind of move through and aren't really pushed to go anywhere in particular, I think is such a strange and unique pleasure in games. And so I highly recommend anyone who hasn't taken a look at it to try it out. It's a little frustrating at first, but give it time and it'll grow on you.
Now, I'd like to circle back to your book. By the way, I have it right with me on my desk here, and I must say, the color is really lovely, and the cover is so cool. It's really cool. And also the typo, the font, you know, it's a beauty. So, your book explores the rich legacy of 2D platform games and how their design choices have kept players engaged for decades. Can you tell us more about how these seemingly simple games convey deeper meanings through their mechanics and design?
Absolutely. You've hit on really the core goal of this book, which is talking about these things that we take for granted when we play, all sorts of abstract and formal design choices. And for me, this re book really came out of teaching game design. So, both at the University of DePaul in Chicago and currently, I've had just wonderful students where I've gotten to teach them how to make 2D platforming games. And to get into this example of how seemingly simple elements can convey deep meaning, I want to talk to you about one of the exercises that I do with them that kind of shifted how they thought about games. So, in chapter one of the book, I delve into how jumping can convey meaning to players in a number of different ways. One of those ways is something that game designers talk about as game feel. And this involves the small variables that go into shaping a player's mechanics. So, in a jump, that might mean the amount of gravity that's pushing down on you, the rate of acceleration that your avatar is moving, the both upwards and also the run speed that they achieve, the number of seconds or frames after leaving a platform that they can still jump, something we call coyote time, and a whole range of others. So there's about 20, 25 variables that can go into just tweaking a jump to make it feel right. In game design language, and game design contexts, we often talk about making a jump feel good, feel like it is enjoyable, or feel natural, like it fits in with the natural physics of the world. In run and jump, I try and shift that framing away from just the good or the natural to focus on how those small changes in variables can create a character or a personality through the action of jumping. So I had one student, for instance, who, by tweaking the speed at which the character lifted up off the ground and then floated down, made their avatar into a pillow. A fluffy thing that had feathers popping up from it every time it jumped, and conveyed that sense not only through the graphical elements, but through the really like the felt experience of jumping. Was it a good feeling? Was it a natural feeling? Who knows? Those weren't really the relevant questions for this student. It was, how do we make this character come alive and become someone that the player identifies with as a pillow? Other chapters in the book deal with other kind of big themes in 2D platforming games. So the second chapter delves into level design and the choices that we make there. The third chapter deals with enemies, and the fourth chapter deals with common sort of meta elements, coins and power-ups and secrets in 2D platformers.
I think it's really intriguing how you draw on both technical discussions by game designers and theoretical insights from structural semiotics to analyze these games. Maybe you could also elaborate on how these approaches intersect and enrich our understanding of 2D platformers.
Definitely. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about what structuralism is, because it's a little bit of an old framework, one that really came into its heyday in the 1960s. And by the 1980s, when the main wave of video game popularity started to rise and crest, had already fallen out of academic favor. And so it's a little bit of a weird thing to bring back, but I think it's a really interesting tool to open up games. So structuralism comes from linguistics. And in particular, the way I think about it is that it's defined by emphasizing how meaning comes from relations rather than what's related. That's a little bit abstract, so let me get into it. So in linguistics, one example might be the difference between the S sound and the Z sound, so S and Z. At a material level, there's a difference, right? The sound waves are literally different. But what we hear as distinct can vary from linguistic culture to linguistic culture. So that SZ difference matters in English, but not in Spanish, for instance, in the same way. And so even though there's no, like in Spanish, there's still a material difference in the sound waves, we don't make the same distinction. So what we hear is different. Now, if we move that into games, we can see in a simple example how we also make meaning through difference. So in Sonic 3, we have three avatars we can play. We can play as Sonic, we can play as Tails, or we can play as Knuckles. Tails moves a little bit slower than Sonic, but he can fly. And Knuckles jumps a little bit shorter, but can climb up walls. Now, if we just had Tails, there wouldn't be a sense that Tails is moving slower, right? Tails is still moving really fast. It's only in relation to Sonic that the sense of being slower even appears to us. Same thing with Knuckles, right? We can make it through the entire game with Knuckles jumps. And so the only reason that they feel short is because we've already experienced Sonic and has that sense of difference between Sonic and Knuckles. So to come back to game design, a lot of the literature in game design, and especially the literature that we use to teach students in game design, emphasizes a kind of formalism. So it might treat the avatar as a ready-made category, something that we can dig into and give students like the best ways to make an avatar. But for structuralism, the avatar only exists as a set of relations. So the avatar is a relation to the world. That means it's pinned to the center of the screen. It is a certain size in relation to the grid of the world. It's vulnerable to enemies, all these kinds of ways that the avatar stands in relation to other things. So by thinking of the avatar not as something by itself, something that we could just take and explore, but something that's always in relation, I think we get two kind of big results. The first is that we can deal with nuances in those relationships that would be invisible if we were just taking each of the pieces, the avatar and the world, by itself. So this gets back to the thing I was talking about with jumping, right? Where rather than just thinking about it as good or natural, we get a huge range of new things we can do with jumping. But it also demystifies the process of creation and invention. When we think in terms of big forms of the avatar as a ready-made category, it takes a kind of individual genius to break those forms and create something new. But if instead we think of them as a set of relationships, a system where one small change ripples out across it, then creativity looks different. It means like we can all be creative just by solving those little problems that emerge in the kind of ripples. So those are the two things that I think we get out of this by bringing structuralism and game design together, more nuance and a better way of understanding creativity.
Now, Peter, your book, and I might repeat the title here, Run and Jump, The Meaning of the 2D Platformer, also offers design exercises to demonstrate how critical interpretation can be used as a tool for game designers to communicate with players. Maybe you can share an example of how such exercises can enhance both player experience and game development.
So this book has a number of different audiences. It's for game studies folks, it's for players, it's for academics who want to teach with games. But one of my key audiences is game designers. And one of the things I'm trying to get at is not just how games do already communicate these meanings, but how they might do it better, right? How they could potentially communicate in ways that we haven't even started glimpsing yet. And so this gets me to one of the exercises that I use to teach game designers, right? In my classes, I hope that they, start making all sorts of even deeper, even richer games. And this comes out really clearly when I first introduced them to a tool to make a 2D level. So one of the really simple tools that I love to draw on is a thing called Pocket Platformer. You can make a level in 5 minutes. When students get started with that, the first thing they do is make the most ferociously difficult levels they can, just like absolutely painful to play through. This is not everybody, but that's a general trend. And so the first step is teaching them that they need to teach the player how to play. This is a kind of classic level design technique pioneered in Mario On, right? So the example is the Goomba comes walking towards Mario, and all that Mario has to do is press the jump button to doesn't have to run and jump at the same time. Mario just has to jump once to land on the Goomba. So we build up over time more and better strategies of play. But that is only a first step, right? That only gets us into a kind of linear progression of more and more difficult challenges to teach the player. I think there's a second step that I want my students to get to, which is that levels also tell rich and interesting stories, right? They unfold over time. There's a clear beginning and an end. There are challenges and confrontations and conflict that fill them up. So without that sense of a story, I think a level can kind of feel empty and hollow. But just by itself, the idea that a level tells a story doesn't give us much to work with. We need to learn the language of that storytelling, how space conveys progress, how it conveys uncertainty and tension and specific contrasts. And I try to make this really literal for my students. So one of the exercises in the book is to take a short story and map it out, right? So find all the moments of rising tension in the story and give them numerical values so that you can chart them into physical space. Find all the moments of uncertainty where space seems like it opens up for the characters in the story and chart that into the openness of the space that you're building. Find the moments where things seem to diverge and build in divergences in your level. And so this way, can this way of like translating a literal story into 2D space can feel a little artificial at first. But when you play through these levels, when my students play through the levels, they get to see how the experiential elements of the story, even though you're radically simplifying and abstracting them, still convey something to the player. And so then they take that forward and start building levels that are not just challenges, but are telling the story that those students are interested in.
I see, yeah. So there's time for one last question, and this is really kind of a meta question. How do you perceive the role of interdisciplinary approaches in advancing our understanding of games and gaming culture, especially in a field such as digital game studies?
Thanks. This is a really interesting question. I thought a little bit about it because I have been in such an interdisciplinary role across my career. And I think really that game studies is fundamentally an interdisciplinary field, that there are people studying this stuff from anthropology departments and psychology departments in English and mathematics and economics and sociology. And in addition to all these kind of disciplinary homes, and I could keep going, we also, get involved in questions of design and development and the technology involved. And so anybody who does this work is sort of enmeshed in so many different systems of thought already. And at times that plurality, I think, can create a desire for more boundaries, right? So that we can say what it is we're doing and mark off the things that are different. And it also helps us, we want colleagues who understand what we're doing. And, when I'm in an English department, most of the people I'm around don't really get why I would be studying games. And so there is a kind of way that game studies puts up its own boundaries. But for me, the sort of intersection that play has and games have across the 20th century, right? So the way that it spreads out into board games and toys, and the proliferation of those in the second half of the 20th century, theme parks and televised sports and game shows, the way that gamification sort of travels into military and educational contexts, the way that academic metaphors in semiotics and anthropology and aesthetics all take up play and games as like crucial terms of thought. All of this, I think, makes the field richer and weirder in ways that draw me to it and I love. And I'm hoping that this book and bringing a theory that, as I sort of argue in the introduction, has been a little bit underground in game studies because of its connections to all these other interdisciplinary modes in anthropology and English and linguistics, that bringing that back and kind of re-engage some of the widespread connections that play always has.
Now let's wait and see. Let's hope for the best. Peter,
Thank you.
thank you very much for being on the show today, for sharing your expertise. And dear readers, don't forget to get the book Run and Jump: The Meaning of the 2D Platformer is out now. Thanks again, Peter.
Thank you.
So, dear listeners, I hope you liked this episode. If you are an author and/or an editor in the field of digital game studies yourself and want to talk about your latest publication, please do not hesitate to contact me under rudolf.indast@googlemail.com. Alternatively, please send me a direct message on social media. You will find me under Rudolf Indast on Facebook and Instagram, and under @GameStudies on Blue Sky and TikTok. Keep it playful. Bye for now.